Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So, I went into philosophy from mathematics, and for a long time, I actually didn't think much about mathematics when I was a philosopher. I sort of did some mathematics on the side for fun, but eventually I started thinking about mathematics. And it's occurred to me that mathematics is kind of unique. It's unique because it combines two things that seem like they might be a bit of a contradiction. So on the one hand, if we prove something mathematically, just say, that's true. Like, there's no more doubt about this, right? I mean, if you go to a philosophy lecture ever, and afterwards, there are going to be people challenging it, saying, that's, you're just wrong about that. Here's why you're wrong. And you guys will hopefully do that to me. You go to a math lecture, there's nothing like that, right? Nobody ever says, you're just wrong. I mean, maybe occasionally somebody's made a mistake. Maybe it's usually just a typo somewhere rather than a real mistake. At most, afterwards, people just say, well, let's look. What maybe we should think about these further questions, etc. But it's just true, right? It's like we're really sure of it. But we have no idea what it means, right? So in other sciences, we know what we're talking about. Many of other sciences, right? Things like geology and biology and stuff like that. We know what we're talking about. Physics, for the most part, we know what we're talking about, unless we get to the really, really fundamental quantum stuff, then maybe we don't know what we're talking about. But for a lot of physics, we know kind of what we're talking about. We know what we're talking about, but we're not quite as sure of it as we are of the math. Right? The math is more sure. Science, you know, is fallible. We can revise it. We change our minds about it. And in particular, sort of, I think about the history of it, right? Ancient science, like geology, chemistry, biology, physics from like 2,500 years ago, it's largely just gone, right? It's almost all wrong, except for maybe some really obvious things in biology, like, that humans reproduce sexually and things like that. But it's sort of much of it is just wrong. It was wrong. But you take the math from 2,500 years ago, it's basically right. Occasionally you find they forgot some assumption. They forgot some axiom. You have to sort of, they were just assumed something implicitly that it didn't state. Okay, you do a minor fix and it stays. So like since, I don't know, about 2,500 years ago, we knew there are infinitely many prime numbers. Okay, so that's something we're quite sure of. We're quite sure there are infinitely many prime numbers, but we still have very little idea what numbers are. But we know there are infinitely many of them because there are infinitely many prime numbers, right? So we've got like this uncontroversial near certainty. We're like, there's no controversy about whether the stuff's true, but at the same time, a deep mystery about it. So that's the sort of one way it's unique. And then additionally, I add, it's like really, really useful and often quite difficult. Okay, so that's kind of the uniqueness of math. So philosophers for about 2,500 years have thought about, you know, what math might be about and what we might be doing when we're doing math. And one of the first people was thinking hard about this was Plato. And Plato thought, okay, look, we've got this physical world around us. It doesn't have the stuff that math talks about. The math of his time was mostly geometry. And geometry talks about things like circles and triangles and lines. There aren't any in the physical world. There's this stuff here, right? But that stuff is not, that's not a circle, that's not a triangle, and that's not a line. That's something else. So we don't have anything like that. But he thought we have a Platonic realm. There are these invisible realities. We call them abstract. And that kind of sounds a little bit denigrating. It sounds like it's not really real. For Plato, they were more real because we sort of know them even more surely than anything else. So there's this more real world of invisible realities where you have real circles and real triangles, real lines, and I shouldn't even try to draw pictures of them because I can't, because the real ones are perfect. And maybe we can add, you know, so we could probably add all the modern mathematical objects to that, like sets and categories and rings and fields and all that kind of stuff, vector spaces. So that's nice. There's this world of forms. That's what math's about. But this raises a bunch of problems. So there's sort of three kinds of problems. One is, what are these things? I mean, they're invisible. Somehow we managed to talk about them. We have some kind of access to these invisible things. But we're like evolved apes, right? How do evolved apes get access with their evolved brains to this non-physical realm of forms where you've got these mathematical objects living there? So you've got they're mysterious objects, and they're somehow we evolved apes have gained access to that. And then finally, we've got this puzzle as to why we care. Why is this so useful? This is one that there's a kind of difference. Like the question of what are these entities and how we know about them is something that the ancient Greeks would think a little bit about. The last one, why it's so useful, I think they didn't think much about because it wasn't that useful then. It's only with modern science the mathematics became really, really useful to us. So for a lot of the Greeks, it had some usefulness maybe for music theory, but maybe a little bit for astronomy. But none of that was that useful. But for us, it's extremely useful. So how do these things that, according to Plato, live in another world, a world of invisible entities, that why are they knowing about them tells us how it helps us build airplanes? So a lot of philosophers who think about math don't go for Platonism because they find these questions are too difficult to answer if you're a Platonist. So they go often for what people call deflationary theory. So these are theories that are supposed to make math a little bit less mysterious, a little bit more down to earth, a little closer to us, more accessible to apes. And so one kind of deflationary theory is logicism. So this idea is that math is all about logic. And logic doesn't tell you if things are true or false. Logic just tells you what follows from what. It tells you, okay, if you've got A and you've got B, then you have, well, A or B, and A and B, and A and not B, and various other things you have, right? But it doesn't tell you whether you've got A and whether you've got B, right? We start with assumptions. So logic just tells you, if you've got this, you've got that. And then logic just tells you what you can prove from that. So the logicists thought math is about what you can prove. So math is about what you can prove from what. Whether the things you're starting with are true or not doesn't matter. What matters is whether you can prove anything from them. However, in the 1930s, the great logician Kurt Gödel proved two incompleteness theorems. And one upshot of these theorems is that it turns out that the logic of proof, like what there is a proof of, is just as abstract and mysterious a question as the question of what are mathematical truths. What is mathematics about? So it turns out that you can encode the idea of a proof into numbers. And then saying that something can be proved is basically just saying a certain kind of number exists. So questions about proof end up just being questions about math once again. And so if that was mysterious, what math is about, what proof is just as mysterious. Proof is just as abstract. Well, almost as abstract. There's a little technical difference, but it's almost as abstract as the math, as the arithmetic. And so it seems like logicism just doesn't really work. This what can be proved is itself very mysterious. And the reason it's mysterious is because what can be proved is not the same as what is proved. I mean, there's a bunch of proofs that mathematicians have done over time, but that's not what we're, you know, that's not what math is about. It's not about the past. It's about what can be proved. And it's not just about what will be proved, what can be proved. And that's the mysterious, the can. That's one kind of approach. There's a kind of even more down-to-earth kind of approach, mind dependence. And there's a variety of these theories. They all kind of agree on this idea that mathematics is in our heads or is in the mind. So where are the numbers? They're in the mind. Now, at first sight, you sort of say, yeah, there's actually sort of immediately some problem jump out at you. There are infinitely many prime numbers. I don't have infinitely many numbers in my head, right? I don't have time to think about all of them. So that's already puzzling. On one version of the theory, mathematical entities are kind of mental fictions. They're like fictional characters, like Sherlock Holmes. If that's right, if math is just stuff in our heads, stuff we've made up, stuff like Sherlock Holmes, then it's really puzzling, first of all, why it's objective, why it's sometimes true and sometimes really false. Like if it's just about what's in our heads, then, you know, your calculus professor grades you as having gotten some integral wrong. And you say, well, but that's what was in my head, and math is about what's in the head. I can't read your mind and tell what's in your head anyway. Who cares what's in your head, right? Doesn't matter much to me. What matters is what's in my head, and that's what I put on the exam, and that should be right. But no, I mean, math is objective. We can go wrong in it, right? What's in our heads doesn't always match reality. So that's one problem, is that what's in our heads is subjective, and math is like the paradigm, what's objective. And secondly, like, why is it so useful? I mean, studying fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes is not that useful, at least not for practical purposes. Maybe it's kind of useful for deepening yourself in the thinking about literature and the deep questions of human life, but it's not like practically useful. Studying Sherlock Holmes will not help a police officer solve a case, right? So it's puzzling why math is so useful when it's just something in our heads and the world's out there, not in our heads. So Plato's theory has a problem. That's the one where math is sort of outside of our heads. And then the problem is the views on which it's more in our heads have problems too. So I want to now switch to a slightly different aspect of the issue, which is the beauty of math. Math's beautiful. Not everybody appreciates all of it, but some things everybody pretty much appreciates. So there's like one kind, I was thinking once, what kind of beauty is there in math? I came up with a list of three things. I have no argument these are the only ones. There's probably more. But I came up with a list of three, so let me just share that list with you. One kind of thing that's really beautiful in math is we have beautiful mathematical objects generated by simple rules. So this is pretty, and everybody can appreciate that. But it becomes even more beautiful when you realize that the rule that generates it is actually pretty simple. I'm not going to quite explain it, but it turns out to be a pretty simple rule. So you've got lots of things like fractals are sort of paradigm examples of this. But then you have other things like knots that people come up with. And then you have things that only mathematicians will appreciate because they don't have a kind of visualness to them. So there's like mathematical objects that are not, you know, sort of visualizable in the same way. They're abstract, but still to the mathematician, they are beautiful and generated by some simple rules or by a simple description in this case. There's another kind of beauty in mathematics. It's one of maybe a little bit, it takes a little bit more to appreciate. It's that they're facts that are beautiful. They vary in how they're beautiful. One kind of thing that happens often is you notice something happens in some case. You know, maybe draw a triangle. You draw your triangle with, 90-degree angle and 45-degree angles. You notice, hey, those add up to 180 degrees. I wonder if there are any other triangles like that. Well, you think about it a bit and you realize, yeah, there are some other triangles where the angles add up to 180. All of them. Every single triangle does this, right? That's really kind of beautiful that they all share the same kind of thing. You might not have expected that initially. So it's sort of things that are true in every case in a kind of lovely way. Every natural number can be written in only one possible way as a product of prime numbers. That's really cool. There's these prime numbers, and there are infinitely many of them, and they're like some kind of basic ingredients for making up all the other numbers. The first two have been known since ancient times, since the ancient Greeks in the West. Some things are like, okay, you have a polynomial of degree n. It has n roots. Okay, you have to count multiplicities. You may have to allow complex numbers, but still, fifth degree polynomial always has 5 roots. 17th degree has 17 roots. That's kind of cool. And there's some things that, you know, sort of take a little bit more explaining. Non-commutative division rings are infinite. I think that's a lovely fact, but again, not everybody. So it takes a while to explain the terms. The last one's kind of lovely too, or the last one in words. There are only 5 Platonic solids. So the Platonic solids are these convex solids, so they sort of stick out, and every face is the same, and every corner is the same. And you sort of wonder, how many things like that are there? And you might think, well, okay, if I think a little bit about it, I can think, there's a cube, it's got squares on every side. What's another easy one? A tetrahedron. That's like a pyramid, where the bottom is this equilateral triangle, and all the sides are equilateral triangles. Very nice. I wonder if there are any more. And you think a little bit, you find a few more. And you wonder, okay, how many are there? The answer is 5. Now, I don't know. To me, that's like super surprising, kind of lovely. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was infinity. I wouldn't have been surprised if it turned out there was only one or none, but 5. There's just something, I don't know. To me, it just always seems really cool. And then the last thing is not a word. This is not anything famous at all like the other things. But just sort of, you talk to mathematicians, and I think that pretty much everybody's got these stories where you're working on a problem and you're thinking about it. What's the answer here? And you find, not always, sometimes you find something where you can't see any beauty about it. That happens. So we may want to talk about that in the discussion afterwards. But surprisingly often you find something rather quite lovely. So you find, okay, suppose I have to have something of this sort. What are some conditions that it would have to fulfill? It would have to be like this and like this. And then it turns out that's not only necessary for it being that sort, that's enough. You sometimes find, okay, you sort of lie down on what's the most obvious things that have to be true of it, and then you find out that's enough for it to be that way. Or you find that something is just seems like really complicated, and then turns out to be kind of simple and lovely. So this one is just a little bit of research of mine that you might kind of wonder why a philosopher is bothering with this, but it comes out of this is something I found like 2 weeks ago working on a computer vision project. So here's a thing. Imagine you've got a drone flying around and the drone wants to locate itself in space. How high up is it and where is it, you know, sort of what bit of ground is it over? And suppose the drone has a camera and there are two landmarks on it. Earth, one lower than the other. Here's landmark one, here's landmark two. And the drone has one more bit of information, one more piece of information. It knows which way is up. It has, you know, it measures gravity. So we know where the landmarks are when you set it up because you've maybe put them up yourself. And you've got your drone flying and the drone knows which way is up. And it's got a camera. So it sees the landmarks. Can it figure out where it is from a single camera image of its landmarks and knowing which way is up? Well, it's an interesting question. And it turns out it's not always. If the drone is like in a straight line along the two landmarks, well, it just sort of sees two dots in the same place. That's not very helpful. There's a few places, there's a small number of arrangements where you just say it can't tell, but those are rare. But for the most part, it turns out from the camera image, the drone can tell, I'm either here or here. There's like two places for it. to be. Most of the time, it can't locate itself. But then I ask this question, when can it precisely locate itself in one spot? And it turns out the answer is just kind of lovely. It can tell itself in a cone above the lower landmark, and the slope of the cone is just the line joining the landmarks. It can tell where it is in the cone below the upper landmark, and then it can tell where it is. This last one was really surprising to me. There's like this third set of regions, which kind of makes for a really pretty picture, which is this plane going through the two landmarks and as horizontal as possible. I mean, slanted this way, but otherwise it's horizontal. When I was doing the initial calculations, I found the cones first, and then I knew there were some extra places where it could do it, and my initial results were showing these extremely messy regions where it was going to be. And they were my initial calculations were just wrong. And it turned out it's just a beautiful plane. So this is like, you know, talking to not under like super important problem, but it just, you talk to people who do math, and every so often and fairly often you find the answer turns out to be kind of lovely and elegant. And once you finish all the work. So that's kind of surprising. And the last kind of beauty of math is one that mostly mathematicians appreciate because it's mathematicians who are mostly engaged in proofs. It's the beauty of proofs. So the ancient Greeks came up with a beautiful proof that there are infinitely many prime numbers. And there's also sorts of other beautiful mathematical proofs. So we've got at least three kinds of beauty in math. Beautiful objects, beautiful facts, beautiful proofs. Why is there so much beauty in math? And what is beauty anyway? Well, a lot of people think beauty is something subjective. It's in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is just what pleases the eye, or maybe the ear in the case of music, or the nose in the case of smells or something. But it's what pleases us in a certain kind of way, right? So it's subjective. Well, that's just not true. Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. No matter how proud I am of this drawing here that I did, no matter how much I think it is like the height of human artistic achievement, it's not. Right? So there are objective comparisons of beauty, and anybody who thinks otherwise is just wrong, right? I mean, if you possibly think this is better, there's just something completely wrong with your taste, right? So that's one thing, right? Just sort of obviously beauty is not subjective. Secondly, what if it is a subjective? It's still kind of puzzling. I mean, we are, as I said a couple of times before, we're evolved apes. How did we evolve to find mathematics beautiful? So even if it's completely subjective, why are we having this perception of beauty in mathematics? I mean, first of all, back when we were evolving, I mean, the human species hasn't changed that much in the last 50,000 years biologically. So back when the species was evolving, maybe 100,000 years ago, maybe more, we weren't doing much math. We weren't proving that there are infinitely many primes. We maybe were counting small numbers of things, how many birds are on a tree or something like that. But there's not much, there's maybe a tiny amount of beauty there, but not much. I mean, none of that sort of beautiful objects, beautiful proofs, beautiful facts is going to be there. So we see this beauty in this math that by and large was discovered in the last 2,500 years, at which point human biology was pretty much fixed in its current form. So why did we evolve to find mathematics beautiful? It didn't help our ancient ancestors find mates. It didn't help them avoid predators. Does it help you find mates now? That's an open question, right, for the math majors, right? So probably the best story from the evolutionary point of view is that it's what people call a spandrel. So that's like it's a term from architecture, but it's kind of a technical term for something that kind of looks striking, seems striking, but doesn't have any point because it's just a side effect of something that's evolutionarily important. Okay. So, you know, maybe there's like no explanation of the exact kind of whorls in our ears or something. Maybe evolutionary theorists will find, have one, maybe not. Maybe, but I, you know, maybe there isn't. And you just say that's just a side effect of our ears evolving a certain way. And there's nothing particularly important about the shape of the, you know, sort of the curves here. Maybe it's a spandrel. And maybe it's like that with math, with the beauty of math. Maybe it's like, okay, so where is beauty helpful? Beauty is helpful, as far as I can tell, in two things from an evolutionary point of view. Maybe you can think of some more, but I can think of only two. One is the beauty of mates is something of an indicator of their health. And so it helps select mates if you go for beautiful mates. Secondly, possibly we have a kind of, we find rotten things ugly. And, you know, sort of at least some healthy to eat things like fruit look pretty. Maybe it, and there's, and certainly smells pretty, smells beautiful. So it's possible it occasionally beauty guides us to finding mates and guides us to finding good food. Those are only two kinds of beauty. There's quite a lot of else that's just not covered by this. Finding tigers beautiful, we can't expect it to be very useful to us. Right? It's just going to lead us to getting eaten. Finding mountaintops beautiful seems, if anything, just a complete harm because you'll be going up them and then you'll fall, you might fall off and then you won't find a mate because you'll be dead. And your body will be mangled and ugly. And in math too, right? I mean, it's the math stuff isn't there. So it doesn't seem like it's helpful. There's just a very, very limited aspect of beauty. And if that's all there is that's helpful, then the rest of beauty, of our perception of beauty, is just a spandrel. It's a meaningless pleasure, no better than drugs. Maybe has fewer, maybe it has fewer side effects. I'm not sure. Okay, so I think even if you think beauty is subjective, it doesn't actually solve the problem. There's a question of why do we get the subjective perception? And we don't really want to say that, I think. We don't want to say it's a meaningless pleasure. And then finally, and I think this is sort of philosophically maybe the most interesting bit, why isn't it the beautiful mathematics is so often useful? So if we have like the sense of beauty that is just this complete side effect of our perception of healthy fruit and healthy mates, how come the formulas that have this beauty end up being useful? I mean, that has nothing to do with healthy fruit and healthy mates. Okay, so on to something closer to getting some solutions, but I want to say a little bit more about the usefulness of it. Something happened in science around 500 years ago. Before that, the science was qualitative. There wasn't much math in it. People discovered things that were useful. Aristotle, mentioning him again, Aristotle, back in the past, did dissections of various things he found in the fish market. He would daily go in the fish market and collect samples for dissection, and he described them with a great deal of detail. And that was good qualitative biological research. But it was purely qualitative. About 500 years ago, science suddenly got more quantitative. And at around the same time, there was this transformation where suddenly you have the physics, which is all about beautiful and simple mathematical theories. So, you know, as you probably know, right, about 2,000 years ago, you have this Ptolemaic a picture of the solar system where you've got the Earth at the center and everything else moving around. So far it sounds like a kind of nice theory with circles and so on. Unfortunately, the most straightforward and simple version of this theory just says the Earth's here, you know, and then the sun and the planets just go around in these circles. Unfortunately, that just can't be true. If that was true, then if we observe planets on successive nights in the sky, it would be just sort of uniformly moving around in a circle. But they don't do that. They go from night to night like that, and then they sometimes come back a little bit and go forward a little bit. It's much more complicated than that. So it wasn't as simple as that, and they knew that because they were actually really good at making observations. Actually, that was maybe one exception to science not being quantitative. The astronomy, they did do a fair amount of calculation. I shouldn't have said it wasn't quantitative at all. And so they thought, we need to fit our observations. And so what they did is they said, okay, here's what happens. The Earth is at the center, and then we've got these circles around it. But the planets and the sun don't just move in these circles. What we may need to do is have them going around circles that themselves go on the circles in these kind of spiral patterns. That worked a little bit better, but still didn't quite fit all the observations. So you have to add more circles going around the further circles. And we call these epicycles. So you've got these spirally things going spiraling around further spirals. And turns out, if you add enough spirals, it fits the data. I mean, this is like a mathematical theorem. This is the Fourier transform. If you add enough spirals, you can fit whatever orbits things actually have. And so you can actually fit the data. And so they had things that were actually pretty good at predicting things. But it was ugly. But they didn't care much. And then along came Copernicus. And Copernicus cared about beauty in the science. And he proposed, we've got the sun in the center, and then Mercury, and then Venus, and then Earth. And then if they all go around these lovely circles, there's just one epicycle left, which is the moon goes around the Earth. That's a sort of little glitch. But otherwise, it's just a lovely little system. It's beautiful. Doesn't quite fit the data as well as the old system, turns out. But that's okay. It's beautiful. And along came Galileo too, right? And Galileo said, yeah, it fits the, yeah, okay, maybe it doesn't fit the data quite as well, but it's so beautiful, it's got to be true. And so why doesn't it fit the data? But he can tell me, why doesn't it fit the data as well as the old system? Anybody know, what's wrong with Copernicus' system? Yeah. Yeah, they're ellipses. So turns out you can do better with epicycles because you can kind of simulate an ellipse with epicycles, but perfect circles are going to be just slightly off. So turns out wasn't as good, but they had this right insight that beauty is a guide to truth. And even though they got the details wrong, it was kind of a valuable insight. And eventually we fixed it. Kepler said they're elliptical and had beautiful mathematical formulas for how fast things are moving around these ellipses, and actually made the elliptical orbits be mathematically almost as beautiful as circular ones. And it worked a lot better. Since then, we have this preference for simpler theories, fewer epicycles, fewer parameters, just generally simpler theories are great. They're more beautiful. Now, here's a sort of unpleasant fact. Simpler theories are pretty much never in practice the best fit to the data. So, you know, imagine this is just made up data, but imagine I've measured these red spots in the lab and I want to know what is the relationship between, plotted them, what's the relationship between X and Y. And I have two solutions. One is I'll draw this line whose slope is 1, it's Y equals X, and it happens to, you know, be pretty good. Most scientists will say, yeah, that's probably right. And what about the fact that they're not quite on? Well, that's what we call experimental error. But why do I need error? Error is a bad word. I could draw a curve that goes right through every single one. It's this function here. It goes right through every single one. Not coincidentally, there are 5 points and there are like 5 numbers here. I can make it fit perfectly. But nobody thinks that's the right answer, right? Like if you were making predictions, suppose you made X a quarter. What do you think Y would be? And you say, oh, it'll probably be here. That would be just dumb, right? You think, Y, the right answer is Y is somewhere around here with a little bit of deviation due to experimental error, right? So we go for simpler theories. Here's another one. I'll tell you about Proust's theory of gravity. So this is my theory of gravity. Imagine Newton's come out with his theory of gravity, and I say, I've got a competitor and it fits the data just as well as Newton's does. So maybe Newton's right, maybe I'm right. It's a toss-up. I should get half of whatever honors Newton is going to get through for the rest of history, right? Because I'm just as likely to be right as he is. So here's my theory of gravity. Here's his. Now, if assuming I've added enough zeros, all the observational data will be exactly the same with an experimental error. But nobody, people would have just laughed, right? If I said, this is my theory, or this is the right theory of gravity, right? So we just think the simpler one, that's the one we go for. Now, you might say, well, is that just something, a matter of convenience or just our own aesthetic preference? Well, if it's so, then we shouldn't trust science. If like our science is based on this subjective preference for prettier things. Like there's one philosopher of science said, why are scientific theories often so beautiful? It's because scientists don't want to spend their time with something ugly. But then you wonder, why is it that the beautiful ones work? Well, the ugly ones don't work often. There are exceptions. Beautiful mathematics seems to be useful as it seems to describe the world correctly or more correctly. But why? So far, there was really, this is the Thomistic Institute. I said nothing much about Christian philosophy. So now I want to bring in three figures from the Christian tradition, specifically from the Catholic tradition. Two of them have a saint in front of their names, St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. The third does not have a saint in front of his name. It's Galileo. But three Catholics. St. Augustine, 4th century AD. Among many other things, he wondered about Plato's theory of the forms, and he wondered about these mathematical objects like the infinity of the numbers. He wondered, where do they live? Where are they? Where is this mysterious realm of the numbers? What are they? And he had this idea. They are ideas. His idea was that they are ideas. So it's kind of like the mind-dependent theory. The mathematical objects are ideas, but they're not our ideas. They're ideas in the mind of God. So the mind of God is where the infinitely many numbers live. And this kind of tames the infinity of the numbers. He says that in a way they're kind of finite because they're contained in the mind of God. There was this professor of mathematics at the place where I studied math who had a book of the history of math, never got published, but he wasn't a Christian. I don't know if he believed in God, but he had this theory about history of mathematics and why it developed the way it did. And his theory was that the ancient Greeks were kind of scared of infinity. They thought infinity was kind of icky. And you read some of the ancient Greeks on infinity, and they do actually kind of, there seems to be a bit of ickiness to it with the way we think about it. And maybe part of the reason for this, he thought, was the Greek gods are finite. And so an infinity, if it's like something like really good, is like bigger than the gods. It doesn't fit in the gods. And so kind of a little blasphemous to think of infinity as something like really important. If you can just make it be kind of like icky and unimportant and you brush it aside. So the finite, it was kind of threatening philosophically to people who believed in finite gods. But once we got people like Augustine with Christianity, then mathematics, because you can fit it in the mind of God and the infinity is not threatening anymore. And so you can have a mathematics of infinity, and then Melzack thinks this is what made calculus possible, was feeling more comfortable with infinity. Took a while to get from Augustine to calculus. Took another more than 1,000 years. But we started moving in that direction. So this is like the mind-dependent theory. The mathematics is about thoughts, but it's about God's thoughts, and that makes it objective. Your calculus professor, if he believes in God, can say, it's all about what's in the mind, but it's not about what's in your mind. It's not about what's in my mind. It's what is in God's mind. And I can prove to you that what you have written down is not in God's mind. And just look at this mistake here, right? So if we take this Augustine story, we can give answers to some questions we can ask about math. So question, what are numbers? What are shapes? What are sets? What are these? Well, they're ideas in the mind of God. And while God is mysterious, ideas are not super mysterious because we have our own ideas. So we kind of know what ideas are. So we kind of know what kind of a thing that is, even if we have a little bit of puzzlement by the God part. How do we know about these things? How do we evolved apes know about these mysterious things in the mind of God? Well, it's because God knows them, because it's easy for God to know them. They're in his own mind. And God knows everything. But it's like, okay, this is not good theology, but just kind of intuitively, right? God knows everything, but it should be easiest for him to know what's in his own mind, right? So certainly God knows them because they're in his mind. And then he creates intelligent beings in his own image. And the thinking of these beings matches these ideas because he made them in his image. We get an extra answer. We knew already some things about what Mathis were doing. It's beautiful. It's useful. But we learn another thing about what's nice about it is it tells us a bit about God's mind. It's an interesting way to think about math. Why is it beautiful? Well, because it's about the mind of God. This is a kind of universal thing about religions. As far as I can tell, like, religions just love beauty. All the religions do. There's like this focus, almost obsession. Obsession makes it sound negative, with beauty in all the religions. You find ancient artifacts and they're beautiful, and one of your first guesses is they're religious. Might be wrong. Might turn out just because people like beauty outside of religion too. But it's like not surprising that religions love beauty. And I think it's because the religions are onto something and onto something about God. God is perfectly beautiful. Now we might still wonder, what about ugly math? If you've done math, especially applied math, you'll have found some things where the formulas just are ugly. What's going on there? I don't know. Maybe it's still beautiful, but less beautiful. Maybe it's part of a larger undiscovered patterns that we have yet to see. I don't know. But that is a puzzle for me. Why does our sense of the beautiful extend to mathematics? Well, we've got our evolutionary story, and that wasn't really very good for this. But we could say here, God gives us a sense of wonder and beauty. It could still turn out to be a spandrel. It could still turn out that somehow or other, if you just evolve the brain for finding good mates and good fruit, you will, by complete coincidence, it will glitch in certain ways. They'll produce a sense of beauty. Except now it's not just a glitch, because God is behind the world and is planning for it and has foreseen it that it'll work out this way and has planned for it to be this way. So you can have the evolutionary story, but still say, from another point of view, it's not just a spandrel. So it's not just subjective. It comes from God. And why does this mathematical beauty describe the universe? Well, maybe because the beauty of the world opens us to the beauty of God. And so God is sort of working in the world to put beauty there, so it opens us to his beauty. That's the first of my three Catholic figures. The second one is St. Thomas Aquinas. And this is a different question about math. It sort of didn't quite come up quite as much, but logic is important to math. We do our mathematical proofs by logic. How does logic work? And here's like two insights that Thomas Aquinas gives us. His first insight is that, this is a kind of deep philosophical question that I've thought a lot about, is what does it mean that something is possible? Some things are impossible, like square circles. Some things are possible, like donkeys and unicorns. Unicorns are possible, they're just not real. What is possible? Well, on Aquinas' view, what is possible is what God can do. So the nature of possibility is kind of grounded in the power of God. So that's one thing. Possibility is what's in the mind of God. And not in the mind of God, it's what's in the power of God. God's power extends, and God's power, on Aquinas' view, extends to the things that are essentially logically possible. So God's power doesn't extend to making 2 plus 2 equal to 5. God is consistent. God's power extends to the things that are logical. And so in a way, logic is a study of God's power. Because by logic, we're trying to figure out what can go with what. And so the study of God's power. And God's mathematical ideas, then you could say, are ideas about what arrangements of things are within God's power. And you can get this intertwining of logic and mathematics, and they're both about the study of God's mind, but also about God's power. And my last figure, the one who doesn't have a saint, because he was, because some people in the church didn't think quite right, and he had no diplomatic skills. So this is Galileo. Here's a sort of famous quote from him, which I'll just read. Philosophy, and remember at this point in time, the word philosophy includes all of science. It's like, what do scientists get now? They get a PhD. That's a doctor of philosophy. So this is the old sense of philosophy. It's all human learning other than theology is philosophy. Philosophy is written in this grand book, which stands continually open before our eyes. And he says in parentheses, I say the universe. So in case you didn't get what the book was, it's the universe. But cannot be understood without first learning to comprehend the language and know the characters that it is written in. It is written in mathematical language, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is impossible to humanly understand a word. Without these, one is wandering in a dark labyrinth. And I actually think this last bit is like a really nice description of maybe not all the sciences, maybe not of biology and so on, but of physics. Before people realized that this book of the world is written in the language of mathematics, physics was just wandering in darkness. There wasn't much progress. Aristotle tried his hand at it, wasn't much progress. Other people tried their hand at it. Maybe you make a little bit of this stuff, but it's mostly not much progress. And suddenly, around the time of Galileo, we started realizing it's written in mathematical language. Let's do some math here. Let's find beautiful math behind this. And suddenly, you're out of this dark labyrinth and suddenly progress is being made. So as you read a book, eventually you learn the genre, what kind of book it is, and the language of the author. Without these, you don't understand the book. And this insight is just central to the scientific revolution. So Galileo's insight makes the scientific revolution possible. This insight that the book of the world is written in mathematics. Now notice this is an insight. This is about God. God isn't mentioned here in this quote, but look, it's a book. I mean, books have authors, right? And I think he obviously doesn't mean literally that's a book with pages, but the author part, I think is really important to Galileo. And so I think that's what he's thinking is God is writing the book of the world in mathematical language. God loves mathematics and writes the book of the world in this. And so the reason this beautiful, elegant mathematics is useful is because God wrote the world in it. And I want to just end this slide with this little remark that as just a purely historical claim, atheists who are engaged in science are cutting the branch they are sitting on. Because they're still going for simpler theories, simpler formulas, more beautiful theories. But if you're not seeing it as the world as having come from God, this correlation between beauty and truth just becomes completely mysterious. There's no explanation for it. And it looks like it made sense that you'd use this beauty as a guide to truth if God was behind the world. But without God, it becomes harder. Now, I don't want to end sort of on this note of, okay, so atheists are in a bad place. I want to note something that if you're cutting the branch you're sitting on, you might fall down, but you might not. You might find another branch nearby to hold on to. So there is the possibility that you'll have some kind of alternate explanation of why it is that simple and beautiful mathematics fits the world. And if so, you might have something else to hold on to. Or another option is you just might not think too much about this question and just do your science and not worry about why it works. And your science still is going to work. But you just want to know why it works. So theism, the theory that there is a God, lets us say a couple of things about math. It lets us say that math is true because it describes ideas in the mind of God. It's something we can know because God created us. It's something that's beautiful because God is beautiful, and it applies to the world because God wrote the book of the world in that language. We can say that logic describes the unlimited power of God. And at this point, we can say this. Well, this is something that we kind of said earlier, but in the context of physics, but we can say this in the context of philosophy. An elegant theory that explains a lot is likely true. The theory that theism, the theory that there is a God, is an elegant theory. It's actually a very simple theory in a way. It says there exists a being that has all the perfections. It's simple in a way, right? It doesn't say it has this perfection to degree 47%. It's like I got 47% of all possible knowledge, 93% of all possible power. That would be a complicated theory. Theism is a simple theory in that sense that it just says there is a being that has all the perfections. Among those are going to be beauty and knowledge and goodness and all these things. But we can sum it up in a brief kind of way. So it's an elegant theory, actually, and it explains a bunch of things, as we saw here, and explains some others. And so a theory like that is likely true. Well, except that you might, unless you can find an alternative. So probably there's a God. I put up Leibniz here, who is one of the sort of maybe earliest philosophers to argue from mathematics and the abstract to the existence of God. But again, there may be alternatives. You might try for some other theories that can explain some of the same data. Pantheism, that the universe is part of God, or the God is the universe. That could explain why, if the universe is God and this universe has a mind, it kind of makes sense. Yeah, so maybe math is about the ideas in the mind of this universe God. And it kind of makes sense if the universe is this God that it will be governed by these ideas that are in his own mind, in its own mind. And that might kind of work with explaining why math is so useful. I think pantheism has some problems. The main problem for theism, and this will be a topic for a completely different thing, is the problem of evil. That's an even bigger problem for pantheism than for theism, because for pantheism, any evil is actually a part of God. So it's not just something, you know, God creates some beings and they freely do something bad and you wonder, why would God allow that? It's like evil seems to be like an actual imperfection within God, because God is the universe. And so that seems more of a problem. Another option is this theory that few people have sort of heard of it, but it's called axiarchism. It's a theory, is this this optimistic theory that everything is for the best and everything must be for the best. And so that's why does math work? Because it's better. It's for the best that it work. How do we know it? Because it's best that we know it. And it can explain quite a lot. Not many people hold this theory, but there's some. This theory, actually, to be honest, one of the two main philosophers in the 20th century to hold it became a Catholic. Because it kind of implies, you might think it actually implies theism. Because if everything's for the best, well, wouldn't it be better if there was a God? So if everything's for the best, there is a God. And he was quite happy with that conclusion. And the last one is kind of this weird thing. There's this, at MIT, this physicist, Max Tegmark, and he has this Pythagorean theory. So the Pythagoreans were this ancient sect/philosophical school that said that the world's made out of mathematics, made out of numbers. And literally, it's not just the numbers are a description of it, they are. And Tegmark thinks something similar. He thinks the world is made out of mathematical objects. We live inside the mathematics. It's not, of course, like you're not a circle. You're a different kind of mathematical object. You're a triangle or a number. You're a different kind of mathematical object. But we all inhabit a universe that is mathematical. Very, very strange theory. On this theory, it's no surprise that mathematics applies to the world because mathematics is the world. One problem with this theory is that it turns out that there's like infinitely many universes because every possible mathematics is a world. That leads to various difficulties. We can talk about those. It's kind of interesting to think like the main alternatives, I think, are all kind of far out there theories too. If people think that God is far out, so are all the alternatives here. And I should say, all three of these theories have problems with the fact that our universe actually appears to be contingent. It appears to have things in it that don't have to be the way they are. But on all of these theories, reality is kind of fixed, because if the reality is God, God has to be the way God is, and then reality has to be the way it is. On axiarchism, everything has to be for the best. And here, all of mathematics has to be the way it is. And so the world has to be the way it is. And there's no possibility, I think, on any of these theories for something like free will. So theism, I think, is the best version. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.